Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Zatarain's, a New Orleans tradition since 1889, and by French Market Coffee, locally roasted in New Orleans for 125 years. From our studios in the Southern Food and Beverage Museum in New Orleans, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. The state of Louisiana lies at the very basin of what's known as the Mississippi River watershed. The watershed basically functions as an immense funnel that drains more than 40% of America. That means what's happening in the mountains of Montana today will affect us here in the Gulf South tomorrow. New Yorker Miriam Horn of the Environmental Defense Fund set out to explore that vast region of the United States and the ranchers, farmers, and fishermen whose actions all have a bearing on our very own Gulf Coast. Miriam takes us along on her voyage of exploration as we meet Montana rancher Dusty Crary and Kansas farmer Justin Knopf. And then, who turns up but our very own Louisiana shrimper, Lance Nasio. Lance gives us his perspective on conservation in the Gulf of Mexico. And we also have a few ranchers of our own here in the Deep South. Mississippi rancher and farmer Justin Pitts weighs in with his thoughts on wolf and grizzly conservation efforts locally. After you hear Justin's take, you might agree that there are some southern ranchers who could use some recovery efforts as well. Ranchers, farmers, fishermen, we've got them all here for you on this week's Louisiana Eats.
My name is Miriam Horn. I work at the Environmental Defense Fund, and I'm an author. I've just published a book called Rancher, Farmer, Fisherman.
In a time of growing partisan rancor, conservation and capitalism are often described as being in direct opposition with one another. But while political talking points on climate become more heated, those who live and work on the land are quietly adopting new methods that sustain production while preserving the environment. In Miriam Horn's book, Rancher, Farmer, Fisherman, she weaves together profiles of five conservationists who work along the Mississippi River watershed. Miriam joined me in the Louisiana Eats studio to talk about her journey, discovering that there's much more that unites Americans than divides us.
Well, I have been inspired by farmers, certainly from the time I was a little girl. I grew up in California, and I spent a lot of time on a farm in the Central Valley run by, it was a big farm, 5,000 acres, but run by a family that already in the 60s was, they had this very long-term vision about what was going to be happening with water and soils and pollinators and riverbanks. And so they were my earliest teachers about the need to take care of land and also the ability of people who work on it every day, who know it as deeply as anyone, how well positioned they were to be the caretakers. I was inspired all over again when in my 20s, I worked for the U.S. Forest Service in Colorado. And in that case, I got to spend a lot of time with ranchers and with people like loggers, and the lesson was really repeated then that people who love these landscapes, know them, often go back generations on them, have a really deep insight, really deep ability to take care of them. And then at Environmental Defense Fund, that's a main strategy that we use to try to make progress in the world, is to really work with people who are important food producers in the country because, as you know, they're managing about 3/4 of the American landscape.
Well, why was it important? What was the significance to you of the Mississippi watershed?
Well, the Mississippi watershed, it comes as a surprise to people who live on either coast, but the Mississippi watershed drains 40% of the United States. It's the third largest river basin in the world. And it has been absolutely central to the American story. The river carries 1 million tons of mud every single day. That's why people call it the Big Muddy. And that mud built a sizable part of the American continent. It built all those rich heartland soils, and it, of course, built the estuaries here in Louisiana that are the source of so much of our wonderful seafood and habitat for birds and source of oil resources and so many valuable resources. So the Mississippi created our natural history. It also really created our national history. It was where we really emerged as a global economic power because of the connectivity that the river itself provides within the country and to the rest of the world, and because it's where most of our natural wealth was and remains, most of our minerals and our timber and our grains and our beans and our wonderful seafood.
You located and designated who you refer to as five unlikely conservationists. And I loved the way you laid it out, because you sort of started at the very top of the Mississippi watershed with a Montana rancher, and you made your way down to a farmer in Kansas, a Louisiana shrimper. So let's do that. Let's walk through or swim through that experience, starting with Dusty Crary, the Montana rancher up there in the North Rockies. What did you learn from him?
Well, Dusty is an amazing character. He is right out of Central Casting as a cowboy. He was actually the Montana State Saddle Bronc Rodeo Champion when he was a young man, several years running. He is a fourth generation on the land. He comes from real Wild West ancestors. He had bootlegging ancestors and coyote trappers and people who often got on the wrong side of the law. And he inherited this amazing ranch land that sits right where the Rocky Mountains meet the Great Plains. It's one of the most dramatic landscapes anywhere on Earth. The mountains shoot straight out of the prairie, this huge white walls of mountain. And it's the only place left in the lower 48 where grizzly bears still move from their mountain habitat down to their prairie habitat. Grizzly bears and wolves and wolverine and lynx and every animal that Lewis and Clark saw when they made their journey up there still roams this. So he raises his cattle kind of half wild anyway, and raising them alongside wild animals. I went up there for calving, and they have a principle of sort of hands off with their cows. So they're just watching from afar. They're letting the cows pretty much do it themselves. And there are eagles swooping down to pick up the placenta. It's like you can't even really believe it's real. And he has really worked to pull together a group of people who over many decades were historically enemies. It was the environmental groups and the loggers and the federal agencies and the cowboys and the outfitters. They pretty much hated each other's guts for a long time. This is not far from where the spotted owl battles were waged. And Dusty and his friends managed to pull together this group of people, cross these deep divides, and protect a 500,000 acres of land up there, a combination of these magnificent private ranches down on the river bottoms and then these high, wild public forest lands. And so they've really protected the last remnant of the American Wild West.
Let's move to Justin Knopf, who is a fifth-generation Kansas prairie farmer.
He is. His mother's family immigrated from Sweden right after the Civil War and homesteaded the land that he still farms. They broke the sod, which was, you know, backbreaking work, and they farmed it generation after generation. The farm flourished. It was beautiful. They were extremely careful farmers, but the Dust Bowl generation first discovered that there were some real costs to breaking out that sod, that prairie wasn't really meant to be ripped up and turned over, and that when you did, you made those soils incredibly vulnerable to erosion, wind erosion and rain erosion and water erosion. You know, we lost an enormous amount of soil during the Dust Bowl. There were sometimes walls 2 miles high of dust blowing across the prairie, and that was all topsoil lost forever.
Amazing they made it through that time.
Well, they hardly did, you know. 2.5 million people were forced to move because of the Dust Bowl. So that was kind of the first real window we got into what the consequences of that kind of farming could be. In the last couple decades, we've also come to understand the ecology of the soil, the microbes that live in the soil, that there are thousands and thousands of species, trillions of organisms there doing really the most important work of any life on Earth, and that all of that plowing and disking had really damaged those microbes as well. So what Justin has done, he's part of a movement called no-tilling, where they are really learning how to farm without disturbing the soil, without cutting into it, without ripping it, without turning it over. They leave it protected, and just they farm like the prairie. They leave it protected under a mat of residues. They leave the stalks in place, and they let the microbes have a slow food diet there, because instead of plowing that stuff under the soil where it actually overstimulates bacteria, which are not that desirable, and it drives out the fungi, they just let it sit there and let the microbes eat it from the bottom up. And so they're really restoring the life in that soil and the structure in that soil, and they're really protecting it. And so Justin's soil is about, by many measures, is now about halfway back to the vitality of native prairie soil, which is pretty amazing because he's only 35 years old.
When we come back from a short break, we continue our journey down the Mississippi River watershed with Miriam Horn, all the way to Louisiana, where shrimper Sandy Wynn is helping build the sustainability of businesses on the Gulf Coast. Stay tuned. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Rouse's Markets and from the Napoleon House, located in the historic New Orleans French Quarter, home of the Pimm's Cup cocktail and the Toasted Mufalada. Lunch, dinner, and private events at 500 Charter Street. If you're just joining us, we've been speaking with Miriam Horn, author of Rancher, Farmer, Fisherman, a book that tells the story of the unlikely conservationists who live and work along the Mississippi River watershed. Well, then we're going to travel down the Mississippi River, and we're going to go from a fifth-generation Kansas prairie farmer to a not even first generation, but immigrant Louisiana shrimper, that amazing dynamo, Sandy Wynn. Tell me about you and Sandy Wynn.
Well, I can tell you that by far the best meals I had while working on this book were with Sandy. Sandy, as you know, is unlike anybody I've ever met. She's got a life force that just bursts out of her, and she has single-handedly really helped this whole community of refugee shrimpers in Louisiana, the Vietnamese and Cambodian immigrants who came here for safe harbor after the wars in their countries, and after just gruesome journeys, you know, where millions of people died, and landed here, found a place that actually reminded them of home. It's the Mississippi Delta is very much like the Mekong Delta. Sandy's father was a fisherman in the Mekong Delta and got them out on his little fishing boat across the South China Sea, and he immediately became a fisherman in New Orleans, knew how to do that. Her mom got work as an oyster shucker, worked two shifts every day, and raised these four kids. Every one of them is a success story. Sandy went off to Tulane and got a business degree at Tulane and was a cheerleader and just really broke a lot of barriers, was the first Vietnamese and the first woman to do a lot of the things that she's done. And since the time she was a teenager, because of her language skills, because of this work ethic and this savvy and this incredible brain of hers, she has been the person that her whole fishing community really looks to help them navigate all of these complicated worlds, to figure out how to be legal about the way they fish, what all the regulations are, to help them get citizenship, to help them get financing if they needed it, and then to help them survive, help them weather these disasters that they keep getting hammered with down here, from the hurricanes to the oil spill to this precipitous wetlands loss. they live all the way down in Beerus and Venice and in the places that are, that, as you know, are just falling into the Gulf of Mexico. They're just dissolving into the Gulf, literally. So the very ground under their feet, under their homes, their fishing grounds are disappearing. Her story is really about how challenging it can be when you're trying to solve a problem of the magnitude of the wetlands crisis in Louisiana and the vulnerability in Louisiana. You know, you have to take a really long view. That's something that all of these heroes have in common, is they don't just think about this week or this month. They think about many generations. They think about the generations that came before them and the debt they owe, and they think about their kids and grandkids and, you know, generations to come. So you have to have that long view, but you also have to have a recognition that a lot of these people are just getting by, that they do have to worry about how they're making this month's mortgage payment, how they're feeding their family this week, and that you have to look at both those stories. You can't just roll over the intimate near-term story. And Sandy is really, from my experience, Sandy is the most important reminder to Louisiana when there's these titanic forces in Louisiana, the politicians and the oil companies and the shipping companies. There's big, powerful forces here, and Sandy never lets them forget that there's also just communities. There's just families and villages down there on the bayou that also need to be taken care of, and that all these other people bring a lot to the table. They're out in those bayous every single day, and so they really can add to the process if their voices are heard.
To me, the outlier in the book is Merritt Lane of the Canal Barge Company. I'd like you to explain to me what would normally make the owner of a very large barge towing company not a conservationist, and why Merritt Lane is.
Well, I think that when people fail to be a conservationist, it's almost inevitably because they don't look very far around them or into the future. They're worried, and our economy, the pressures of Wall Street and everything else have pushed people to worry about quarterly profits and make shortcuts. And Merritt, I think, in large measure, because of his family heritage, you know, he comes from centuries of civic leaders who have taken their responsibility very seriously, whether they were ministers or doctors, have really worked to better the communities that they lived in and have played an important role in Southern history. Merritt takes that really long view, and what he's really seen is the vulnerability of his family and his community in New Orleans and the vulnerability of his mariners out on those towboats with those barges. He really sees the effects of this extreme weather. He sees his captains having to deal with, you know, extreme drought where they're almost running aground, and then 8 months later, extreme flood where, you know, they're navigating through these bridges with the river just, I mean, you guys all know what this river looks like
indeed.
When it's roaring. They go up and down the Mississippi and its tributaries mostly with chemical barges.
That alone is kind of a hot button.
Right. I mean, so, yeah, you wouldn't really think that somebody whose biggest customers are companies like ExxonMobil, that wouldn't be where your mind would first go looking for a conservationist. But one of the things he says is that the problem he's had with the environmentalist conversation is that it doesn't finish the sentence. It says, you know, stop doing that. And then what? It's that you still have to move freight in the United States. We're not just going to shut down the economy. He offers the safest, cleanest way to move these chemicals and fossil fuels. We're not, you know, bringing down the hammer tomorrow. I mean, yes, we should be moving ourselves away from fossil fuels and probably away from a lot of these chemicals, but transitions happen slowly. And in the meantime, you want to be doing the best that you can, be as safe as you can and as responsible as you can in that work.
That's so incredible. It's such a wonderful story. And it's a wonderful book. And my goodness, you've spent a large part of your life doing this type of work. And now 3 years devoted to just writing Rancher, Farmer, Fisherman. What are you most concerned about when it comes to the future of the Mississippi watershed? And what is your greatest hope for it?
Well, I think it's impossible to ignore climate change and that, you know, everything that is happening has more pressure on it because of climate change. So you guys all know about relative sea level rise down here, but you know that that at the same time that your land is sinking into the Gulf is rising, and that means you have one of the fastest rates of sea level rise in the world. Every problem that you look at that is affecting farmers and ranchers and fishermen is being made worse by climate change. Climate change is an accelerator of those problems. So, you know, I think that is what worries me most. One of the really heartening things is that a lot of the food producers are actually in a position to help solve the problem. So when a farmer like Justin does no tilling, he actually starts rebuilding the carbon in his soil and taking it out of the atmosphere. When the wetlands grow here in Louisiana, they do the same thing. They take up their, in fact, they're one of the most efficient banks for carbon. So they can also help really, they not only clean the water, they can also help clean the air.
Well, thank you for running the flag up on all the things to look for and giving us some hope at the same time, too. It was such a pleasure to have this opportunity to speak with you.
Thank you, Poppy. It's wonderful to be here.
Miriam Horn, author of Rancher, Farmer, Fisherman.
My name is Justin Knopf. I am a farmer in central Kansas.
One of the conservationists profiled in Miriam Horn's Rancher, Farmer, Fisherman is Justin Knopf, fifth-generation farmer from Salina, Kansas. To get a better understanding of Justin's unique perspective and learn about his sustainable farming practices, we spoke to him by phone.
My brother and I are fifth-generation farmers here on our family farm, and wheat is certainly one of the mainstays of our farm, has been, of course, for generations, and likely is to continue to be that way for generations.
In Miriam Horn's book, Rancher, Farmer, Fisherman, one of the things that you discuss is what you call the new Dust Bowl in Kansas. So what's going on out there?
Well, soil erosion is still a very real threat to the High Plains. We still are farming on the prairie where our weather is, we just have extreme weather. And, you know, some folks say and experience that it's getting more extreme all the time. As a farmer, the soil is certainly an essential resource, natural resource to me. It's what my entire living is based upon, the soil and the weather, basically. And it's not a replaceable resource. It takes generations to build soil. However, if we mismanage it and leave it exposed and vulnerable to harsh weather conditions, we have the risk of losing the soil.
Well, that is why you practice no-tilling farming, right?
That's right. The basis of no-till farming, it's a different mindset. It's really kind of reversing a trend that's been followed since the prairie was first broke for farmland, actually. The settlers and frontiersmen, the first farmers here, used plows and horses and livestock to turn over the prairie grass, to turn that soil and plow that grass under and to make it so where they could plant seeds and cultivate. And when that happens, it just leaves that soil exposed. So we're basically reversing that trend. So anytime we harvest a crop now, that residue that's left in the field stays on the top of the soil surface to act as a shelter for that soil. So it's sheltered from wind, it's sheltered from heavy rainfall events, and it's also sheltered from high and low temperatures. It's just a more stable, resilient environment with that insulation of heavy plant material left on top of it throughout the entire year.
So, Justin, this is where the cover crop comes in, right?
Yeah. One of the foundational premises of transitioning to a no-till system is adding more diversity into the system, always trying to better emulate what the prairie teaches us. And so we still grow a lot of wheat, of course, but we added other crops into the mix, such as soybeans and warm season grasses such as corn and grain sorghum and perennial alfalfa. And then that was kind of our first step that we made 15 years ago when we moved into this system. And now, as of 5 years ago, we're still learning how to add more diversity through what you asked about, these cover crop mixes, which may be a mix of anywhere from three to maybe as much as eight different plant species, different types of seed all mixed together.
Well, that is so fascinating. And I have to admit, I'm reading the book and I'm reading about all this revolutionary thinking that you're doing. And then I discovered this, what to a lot of people I believe would be a great dichotomy, that such an environmentally conscious farmer is still using chemicals, GMO seeds, and Roundup. So would you please give us your point of view from that side of the coin?
Sure. That's a really fair question. You know, there's a lot of questions, a lot of concerns in the marketplace and in our culture about some of the technology and the science, the tools that we use on, you know, so like you mentioned, GMOs and herbicides and things that I use on a daily basis to produce the things on our farm. And so I think there's this perception that's easy to buy into, that in order for a farm to be environmentally responsible and kind of on the cutting edge environmentally and from a sustainability standpoint, that they need to be a small organic farm that would be farming at the scale that my grandfather would have in the 1950s. And I think that perception is not quite accurate. And please don't misunderstand me. I have nothing against organic farms and that that market in our food marketplace, and fully support freedom in the marketplace and access to that market. However, as I look at my ecosystem and the environment and the climate and the crops that I'm working with, I see it as more ecologically responsible and more environmentally responsible to produce as much as I can per inch of water that we receive, per acre of land that I have the short time to be a tenant to, a steward to. And in order to do that, I think it's, for me as a farmer, I feel it's irresponsible for me to throw science and technologically advanced tools out the window based on a lot of things that I believe are based on fear.
Justin, I know that you have a very clear picture of the place that you hold in the whole Mississippi watershed. Would you like to talk with me about your vision of where you are and the importance of that watershed?
Just a year ago, I had an opportunity for the first time to visit New Orleans, your wonderful city, and I so enjoyed it. It's the first time that I had oysters, and I absolutely loved them, which was a stretch for me. My wife would tell you, because I'm more of a kind of steak and potatoes guy, of course, but I absolutely loved experiencing some of the food and the people. But the most significant moment was about an hour and a half that I had. I just walked from downtown down to the river, and it was mid-morning. It was a quiet morning. There were a few joggers out, kind of overcast, and I just stood there and looked at that magnificent river flowing by, and there's these huge ships and the tugboats and the pushing barges. And then on the other side of me, across the grass area, is a train. And this train is carrying grain cars. And it's just, it's hard for me to describe, but it was a very emotional, it sounds silly, but it was a very emotional moment for me to stand there in awe of the interconnectedness that river represents and that your city represents right down there, that all of this material from the heartland, all these grains, all this food, all these products that are coming from the soils, from the energy that's been captured by plants and our fields here in this great heartland is flowing right there through your city out to the entire rest of the world, as well as all that water that's draining our heartland. And to be there and see where it all ends up, it's just such a perspective. And it was a really, really meaningful time for me, and I really appreciated that.
Thank you so much for making the time to talk with us on Louisiana Eats. And here's hoping for a great crop this year.
Oh, I so appreciate it, Poppy. Thank you for your warm spirit and for hosting me today.
Justin Knopf, fifth generation farmer from Salina, Kansas.
Trying my patience, try pink carnations, red roses and yellow daffodils. Don't forget the flowers someday, I know you will.
My name is Lance Nacio. I'm owner and operator of Anna Marie Seafood. I have two shrimp boats and we produce some good quality Louisiana shrimp.
While compiling stories for her book, Rancher, Farmer, Fisherman, Miriam Horn spent a long time on the Gulf Coast with our Louisiana fishermen. One of them was shrimper Lance Nacio. I asked Lance to share with us how he became involved with Miriam's project and his take on coastal conservation.
I met Miriam about 4 or 5 years ago, and she was brought to me by the Environmental Defense, and they were working on a documentary on the watershed of the Mississippi River. I took her out a couple times in the swamp and showed her how the people in South Louisiana live off the land and live off of the resources.
It is really, really a water-to-table existence, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I've always grown up living off of the land. I lived in a trapping camp when I was a kid. I took a boat to school, per se, you know. So, I mean, I know it inside and out. My father and my grandfather, I mean, I have great respect for them because they were men of not much knowledge but ton of resources. You know, they use their hands to make a living from the land. They use what Mother Nature had to offer and made a good living out of it. And that's what I respect. You know, I was brought up doing just about anything, pulling just about anything we can from the water, you know, changing with the seasons. So, you know, that's how I learned a lot about the ecosystem and the estuaries of South Louisiana is by firsthand experience growing up doing it.
Well, when we talk about environmental protection and our precious Mississippi watershed and the waters out into the Gulf, I know that you're one of the people who really puts his money where his mouth is. Tell us, how did you first become aware of the need for environmental protection as a shrimper?
Well, Poppy, growing up, you know, off of the land like that, I've seen a lot of changes in my lifetime. I'm only 45 years old, but I've seen a tremendous amount of changes with coastal erosion and subsidence and land loss. You know, we had several hurricanes in a row, and what it's done is brought an influx of salt water into the estuaries, and it killed off a lot of the native vegetation. And you know, in that time, we had a lot of subsidence and erosion that occurred. So, I mean, I've seen some pretty traumatic things in my lifetime in the wetlands.
And so what do you set out to do to make a difference?
Well, you know, I mean, we want to be good stewards to the environment. We want to leave it better than what we found it. So it's all about producing a good, clean, and fair product. You know, I mean, we want something that people will be proud to serve.
What makes your shrimp so special?
Well, our shrimp, what makes it special is our harvesting techniques and then the way we handle it once it comes on board. You know, we start a cold chain as soon as we possibly can. And what we want to do is capture that out-of-the-water quality of the shrimp and convey it on to the chef, the end user, the consumer of the shrimp.
Someone who features very largely in the fisherman part of Rancher, Farmer, Fisherman is Sandy Wynn. What has been your experience with Sandy?
Sandy's a community leader. She helps the Vietnamese fishermen, but she, her doors are open to any fisherman. And she's helped me on many occasions with different types of paperwork that I wasn't, you know, fully abreast of. I mean, she's helped us out quite a bit. You know, she's all about, you know, keeping the fishermen on the progressive cutting edge with these refrigeration grants. She's helped a lot of fellow fishermen, you know, get these grants and to bring back the stuff that I do. These grants that were going around a couple of years ago, was most of the equipment that was offered was stuff that I had produced on my boat, the type of equipment.
Wow. Explain how that happened, Lance.
Well, you know, I mean, we did a good job at what we do, and people took note, and you know, they see that that's the future. You know, I mean, we can't do things the way we've always done it in the past, and we need to you know, treasure the resource, and what we do in is capturing, treasuring the resource.
Lance Nacio of Anna Marie Seafood. What is winter wheat, and where is most of it grown in the United States? Stay tuned, and we'll answer that question when we come right back. Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Zatarain's, and from French Market Coffee. French Market Coffee's premium blended beans are locally roasted in small batches, creating a coffee that can only be called New Orleans Bold. Here's this week's culinary quiz question, brought to you with support from Popeye's Louisiana Culinary Institute. What is winter wheat, and where is most of it grown in the United States? Winter wheat is a strain that is planted and germinates in the fall, becomes dormant in winter, and then resumes growing and is harvested in the spring. Winter wheat accounts for 70 to 80% of all wheat production in the U.S., with the largest amount being grown in Kansas, where over 10 million tons of the stuff is harvested every year. Winter wheat is prized for its high gluten protein, which is why it's ideal for making yeasty, delicious bread. That's why the land Justin Knopp farms is known as America's breadbasket. Kansas has been one of the wheat-growing epicenters of America since before the territory was even opened in 1856. So the next time you bite into a crusty loaf of bread, thank our Midwest farmers who make that bread possible. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats.
I wanna be a cowboy sweetheart. I wanna learn to rope and to ride. I want to ride o'er the plains and the desert, out west of the Great Divide.
Now that we've gotten a closer look at conservation through the lens of the farmers and fishermen described in Miriam Horn's book, Rancher, Farmer, Fisherman, we have one final occupation to examine: ranching. For this topic, we thought it would be interesting to speak with two ranchers whose opinions differ on the topic of conservation. We begin with Dusty Crary, the cowboy featured in Miriam's book.
My name is Dusty Crary. I'm a rancher and an outfitter. Lived all my life west of Choteau, Montana on the Rocky Mountain front.
When we called Dusty, he was driving in a remote area of Montana, so he pulled his truck over to the side of the road to share with us his take on the recovery of wolves and grizzly bears.
Well, it's certainly controversial, and they're here to stay. And I think one of the lessons from Wolf Introduction that I think is important for everyone to understand is that whether it's a plant species or a wildlife species or a fish, whatever, the Endangered Species Act on its own is a great idea, a very neat American concept, and it's been successful to some degree. But oftentimes, the burden of recovery comes on a very, very few individuals at sometimes great expense. And I'm not sure that we always appreciate that in this country. We welcome the successes. And I think you'd have, even the most hardcore, trusty old conservative rancher, they love wildlife and they believe in wildlife, but they also believe in themselves and believe that they have a legitimate place to conduct their activities as well. And so I think that whole evolving process that went from some real hostility in the 1980s, now that really helped the wolf on the Rocky Mountain front. The wolf has, you know, more or less in the Northern Continental Divide been allowed to just reestablish itself rather than introducing larger quantities like they did down south, which I think some would look at that now and say maybe that was a little abrupt. But the grizzly bear kind of paved the way and did a lot of the heavy lifting for the wolf. And, you know, I think that with management and give and take from all sides, those animals are secure and they won't leave the landscape again. And I think we'll have ranchers on the front and we'll have wolves and grizzly bears and all the other things that belong there.
Dusty Crary, fourth generation rancher on the Rocky Mountain front.
And I'm Justin Pitts. I'm a fifth generation from Jones County, Mississippi. I'm a stockman farmer. I raise heritage breeds of livestock, pretty much all the breeds that you would have found in the Deep South prior to 1900.
Closer to home, Justin Pitts has a different take on nature conservation, particularly when it comes to wolves and bears in his pastures. Justin, welcome to Louisiana Eats.
Thank you so much. Pleasure to be here.
In our conversation with rancher Dusty Crary, he indicated that he knew there was a bit of an issue with the reintroduction of the red wolf in the South. What have your experiences been? Tell us about this.
Disastrous. The red wolf has hybridized with the coyote and with feral timber wolf German Shepherd hybrids that people have bought as pets, got scared of, whatever, they've thrown them out. A true coyote weighs between 20 and 30 pounds. I captured and dispatched one that weighed 72 that was killing sheep. There's no telling at the tens of thousands of dollars that the red wolf coyote hybrids have cost me in raising sheep and poultry. I've lost 3 calves this year to these, I don't know what the proper word for them would be. They're not coyotes, they're not wolves. Fur fishing game has begun to reference them as brush wolves.
Brush wolves, that's a whole new term, isn't it?
It is, and they, you know, kind of think this is Darwin's theory at work. This is a new species evolving.
This experience with the reintroduction of these wild animals, wolves, bears, even your grandfather had an opinion, because that must have happened during his time on your family land.
It did. He died several years ago, but I can remember watching a television program that they had on our evening news station where they had reintroduced the black bear. My grandfather was just livid. His grandparents, who were my great-great-grandparents, he said, you know, they worked to eradicate these animals to where we could raise our livestock, and now they're reintroducing them. And the problem with the reintroduction is if the bear destroys livestock, you cannot kill the bear. He's federally protected. One of my students' fathers was a beekeeper. Some 300 stands of bees were destroyed. The federal government didn't offer to pay the man, and he lost all those beehives. Plus, they said, if you kill him, we will arrest you. You will know what Leavenworth looks like.
And that's happened to some of your friends and associates in the farming.
Yes, a gentleman over in Washington, Mobile County area in South Alabama had this experience. He was archery hunting. He was up a tree in a tree stand. A female black bear came into his food plot, climbed the tree he was in. He tried to kick her in the nose. He did everything he could to send her back down. He had a .357 on him. She lacerated his leg. He shot her. He almost bled to death. They had a federal game warden outside of his hospital room in the emergency room, so whenever he was able to leave the hospital, he could be incarcerated. And this was self-preservation. I mean, it wasn't like the man went out and said, hey, I think I'll shoot a black bear today.
So, Justin, I've always regarded you as one of the Southern Noahs because you're growing out those heirloom vegetables and shepherding and taking care of those heritage breed animals. Where do you think the tension between that and this problem with the predators that people don't understand lies?
Most people who do not depend upon livestock and farming for their livelihood don't have an appreciation of how much it costs, what they are worth. I have 40 some odd cotton patch geese. Now, they may not mean anything to anybody else, but that was my great grandfather's geese that they turned into the cotton fields. It would take just a matter of minutes for some of these wolf-dog hybrids to destroy the flock. Several years ago, a young lady that I kept company with, she and I went out of town to my family's to spend the weekend. We ride our horses and mules through the woods. We still have our wagons and things. And while she and I were gone, these red wolves, coyote hybrids, got in my chicken yard and killed 140-some-odd pullets. They didn't eat the chickens. They just killed them. They stacked them 4 and 5 to the pile. And they were just, it was a pair of parents training the young how to kill. Now, eventually, I did take Papa out, but Mama and the young got away. I don't know what it's going to take, because you have people who have this Disney, the fox and the hound, and that's another thing we have trouble with up home is the red fox. Red foxes prey on the piglets, the poultry. They'll get kids and lambs and house cats. Red foxes love house cats.
Oh, no.
And they have cleaned me out. I have one cat left, and she's traveling when she goes from one building to the next.
Wow. Well, Justin, you know, I've always been your biggest fan.
Thank you.
And I know you as a conservationist of a very special kind.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity to have a chance to show the stockman's perspective of this. Yes, I do like to hear the wail of the coyote on a cold night. I like to hear that. But at the same time I'm listening to him, I'm wondering, well, what's going to be gone tomorrow morning? What's he going to get into tonight?
Justin Pitts, fifth generation stockman and farmer from Jones County, Mississippi. That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Have you missed an episode of Louisiana Eats? Hear today's show or catch up on previous editions anytime online at itsneworleans.com, where you can also subscribe to the podcast and take us with you wherever you go. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Zatarain's, French Market Coffee, and Rouse's Markets. Additional support for Louisiana Eats is provided by the Shreveport-Bossier Convention and Tourist Bureau and from Dickie Brennan's Steakhouse,
a local New Orleans steakhouse serving prime beef in New Orleans French Quarter. Original theme music by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes. Big thanks to producers Joe Schreiner, Sarah Holtz, and Reggie Morris. Come visit us anytime in our Louisiana Eats studios at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. Don't forget to find our recipes and see what we're up to at poppytooker.com. You can check us out on Instagram and Facebook as well. I'm Poppy Tooker. Louisiana Eats is a production of Poppy Tooker Broadcasting.